We have this morning in our plenary two speakers, and one is Peter Calthorpe, who's one of the founders of the New Urbanism, one of the original six, to talk about the regional perspective and very useful for Colorado in terms of looking at what's happening in California. Sometimes Colorado looks at California in a negative way, but sometimes the two states can learn from each other. I know that for Californians, they can take comfort in the fact that they're not Texans. Carol Coletta is the head of CEOs for Cities, which is based in Chicago, and they've been for some time now a strong partner of CNU. They're deeply supportive of urbanism, both in terms of design and the whole picture of cities, partnerships between universities, the city government, and the city business community in various cities around the country. Carol took over the CEOs for Cities a few years ago and has added several new dynamic dimensions to CEOs for Cities. She is somebody who speaks positively about cities and has for many years, understanding that cities are the basis for regional economies, that the cities are basis for the national economy, social culture, and so she is an advocate, not somebody who feels sorry for cities but sees the opportunity in cities and the opportunity in regions. And so she's been an inspiration to us. We work very closely with them. We have a proposed common grant proposal that we're working on to work even more intensely together. And so it's a joy to work with Carol Coletta. And at this time, I introduce Carol Coletta, President and CEO of CEOs for Cities.
Thank you, John. Thank you, John. As some of you know, I also do a radio program called Smart City. And for a number of years, I have had the opportunity to interview a couple of people each week. Over 8 years, that adds up. And many of you have been guests on the program, and I appreciate it. So I've been thinking about what makes cities smart for a very long time. Now, here's one company's version of smarter cities. IBM says smarter cities have safe neighborhoods, quality schools, affordable housing, and traffic that flows. It's all possible, according to IBM, but is flowing traffic really the mark of a smarter city? Is it really that central to the new American dream? Well, how about this as an alternative? Could walking be part of the new American dream? Architecture critic James Gardner believes New York has become the first city to have entered the post-industrial age with this Times Square experiment in pedestrianization, a template of how the world may soon look and feel. You may have read the story in the New York Times yesterday that says the Times Square experiment has run out of lawn chairs. For the first time in history, urbanness has become its own reward. Now, for CNU members, walking is not a new story. A quick review of any of your iconic projects finds walkability as a central feature. Of course, CNU didn't discover the joys of walking. You rediscovered it by studying and enjoying the neighborhoods that we all love best. And thank goodness that you did. Because walkability and two of the factors that underpin walkability, density and mixed use, are fundamental to what we at CEOs for Cities call the city advantage. Cities, it turns out, have natural advantages. Cities naturally, if you let them work right, offer variety, which is a wide range of valued choices. They naturally offer convenience, that is, the wide range of value choices closer at hand. Discovery is another city advantage. Cities offer people more chances to discover things they didn't know they liked, things they didn't know they wanted to know, and people they didn't know they could make things with, including ideas and innovation and fun and even babies. And cities naturally offer more opportunity to their citizens in the form of access to jobs and education and smart people. But here's the problem. We keep screwing it up. We keep undermining the city's natural advantages. Instead of building compact cities that magnify, amplify, and intensify these city advantages of variety, convenience, discovery, and opportunity, we've blown it. Now, you all know that because since its inception, the Congress for the New Urbanism has dedicated itself to remedying this sad and really stupid situation we find ourselves in. Four cars in every garage may have once been the dream of Americans, but it's now clear that that is not only time-consuming and isolating, it not only undermines the city advantages, the natural advantages of cities, and God knows we need every advantage right now we can find, but it's also expensive. Last November, CEOs for Cities recognized that if in the nation's top 51 metro areas, we could make some very small improvements in performance in three key areas, it could mean big money to local economies and then cumulatively a lot of money in the national economy. And one of those key areas is an area that you know a lot about, and that is vehicle miles traveled. What we found is that if we could make a 1 percentage point increase in talent, which is actually the percent of people in your population with a 4-year college degree, a 1 percentage point increase in talent, a 1 mile per day reduction in vehicle miles traveled, and a 1 percentage point decrease in poverty in each of those top 51 metro areas, the metro areas with a million or more people in the U.S., that would amount to a $166 billion annual dividend. Now, that used to sound like real money, but I would just emphasize to you, this is $166 billion every year. So that's like an annual stimulus to the local economies and, again, cumulatively to the nation. So what I want to do for the next few minutes is just focus with you on what I think is most relevant to CNU, and that is the green dividend, although I want to say quickly that I think based on our research, and this is not the subject this morning, but based on our research, I could tell you a whole lot about why your work matters centrally to the talent dividend as well. But let's focus on the green dividend. If we could achieve the green dividend in each of those 51 metro areas, it's worth $29 billion every year. So that's the part of the city dividends that the green dividends represent, $29 billion. And let me tell you how we got to that number. We know that VMT, you know that VMT varies among metro areas. The people of Houston, Charlotte, Jacksonville, Nashville, and Indianapolis drive the most. And New Orleanians, New Yorkers, people of Sacramento, Portland, and Philadelphia drive the least. And what this, the fact that this variation exists suggests that, in fact, achieving that 1 mile per day reduction in VMT is indeed possible because you see that spectrum of performance among metro areas. The other thing that suggests it's very possible is, of course, the reality that we've seen in the last 24 months of these reductions. So it's So what we know about the green dividend, I should tell you, is $29 billion is 1 mile per day. So keep multiplying that by the number of miles we could really reduce by our VMT. Let me tell you a little bit more about this. We know that metro areas that drive less spend less on transportation. That's not hard to figure out. And we know, too, that compact urban development and diverse and functional transportation choices, those things that you've been advocating since your inception, give people alternatives to cars, and therefore they drive less. And here's the chart that shows the relationship between the amount of driving you do and the amount of your income you spend. Each vehicle mile traveled cost us about 50 cents, which is the total fuel, maintenance, and capital cost. And at current gas prices, fuel represents about a third of those total vehicle costs. So, again, keep in mind, as fuel prices go up, the value of the green dividend goes up. And I should say one other thing. What this calculation does not include, because we can't do it at a national level, but we can actually do it at a local metro level, is it doesn't calculate into it the value people put on their time that they spend driving. And we've done that calculation in a few places, Portland, Tampa, Chicago, maybe a few others, but I know we've done them in those communities. And if you include the value, the way people value their own time spent in a car, this number goes way up. So again, I would emphasize to you, this is a very conservatively calculated dividend. Let me show you what this means. If in Chicago, and this is, these are all metro numbers, not city numbers, but if in Chicago metro we could reduce today's 21.2 miles per day VMT to 20.2 miles per day, it's worth $1.7 billion annually to Chicago metro. That's a lot of money. If we could do it in Houston, it's worth $1 billion. If we could do it here in Denver, it's worth $440 million annually. Now, needless to say, everyone's looking for money, more money to circulate in local economies today. This is one easy way to get it. And if you, again, I would just, if you take Chicago, Houston, Denver, add them up with the other 51 metro areas, you get that $29 billion a day. At CEOs for Cities, we don't intend to stop with this calculation of the green dividend. We have underway now we're working with the Walk Score data and looking at the relationship between a property and then a neighborhood's Walk Score and its value. And I can tell you, and this probably will be out in July, but I can tell you that the numbers are very striking. And it basically shows that the higher the Walk Score, the higher the value of the home, which is quite remarkable. It proves the case you've been making for many years. And, you know, if bankers knew this, if homeowners knew this, if mayors and city councils and planning boards who are desperate to hold on to their real estate tax value today knew this, you have to wonder what would go through their minds the next time they're asked to make a decision to fund or to approve another car-dependent development. I mean, once you've been through the hard times and you see those real estate values plummet and you see the property tax values or the income plummet, what decision do you think they're going to make? So I think this will get the cumulative effect of the green dividend and what we're calling the walk value dividend will, I believe we're going to get their attention, but we need your help to do it. We want to be your partner in getting this important message to urban leaders. I think together we can make cities that deliver on the city advantage, the green dividend, and what we anticipate will be this WAP value dividend. It will put more money into local economies, and I think actually it's just going to make cities a whole lot more fun. So thanks.
Thank you very much, Carol. If the if a recession has any positive value whatsoever, it's a chance to make the economy more efficient, more productive, and work better for everybody. And building urbanism and reducing the amount of energy per unit of output in the economy is something that can help everybody. And the measurements that Carol's developing, I think, are going to be very useful for those who are serious about making our communities more effective and more efficient coming out of this recession, should it end soon, which I hope it does. But it won't if people don't actually try to make this situation better. The idea that we can just get better by being a cork in the ocean and rolling with the times, whatever happens, that's not going to be the case. This is a recession that was caused in part by the inefficiencies of the American economy. Peter Calthorpe thinks about these things a lot. And his work in California, his work around the world, his work right here in Denver with the redevelopment of the Stapleton Airport and with the advice that he's given for planning for the region, all contemplate the connection between jobs, the economy, housing, living arrangements, traveling arrangements. All of these things are things that Peter has focused on for many years. His most striking work early in his career was under the administration, within the administration of Jerry Brown, where he changed the plan for Sacramento, California. They were about to implement a plan that Ronald Reagan had, his administration had created, to create a Grand Plaza in the middle of Sacramento, much like the one in Albany, New York. Any of you have ever been there and seen the full expression of Nelson Rockefeller's ego played out over the city of Albany with adjoining parking facilities and so forth. Peter, along with help from some of his colleagues, stopped that and turned it around, and now Sacramento's become a city with a lively downtown, with a great transit system that was contemplated by their plan. And then on from there, in community after community, looking at the big picture, putting it all together, creating the detail that makes it work. And he's been thinking a lot about California, particularly recently. California is under a lot of stress. California's political system seems to be cracking and going into mega stress. But somebody's calmly looking at the situation and trying to find a way to make it better, and they've had some success with things like high-speed rail and climate planning for the whole state that could set the groundwork for once again California to be leading the nation in creating prosperity that spreads through the whole population. And so it's my pleasure to introduce Peter Calthorpe.
Let's see if I can straighten out the wires here. So I'm going to continue in the same vein, because I think now more than ever, numbers matter. And actually being able to measure, quantify the benefits of urbanism in terms of the current political environment is what we need to do more than ever. And if we take this one simple, and I'm always nervous when we reduce urbanism to one variable, carbon, economics or social or health or anything like that. It's always dangerous whenever you, because actually what John was talking about was 30 years ago, and it was during the oil embargo, and all of a sudden we had a lot of attention, a lot of energy behind alternative energy and transit and all the things we believe in today. We advanced it, and then the whole thing came crashing down when Ronald Reagan was elected, because he immediately yanked all the subsidies out from underneath the alternative energy systems. He took all the money away from the Department of Energy that was doing research into solar technology and efficient buildings and things like that. And bingo, the whole thing went away very rapidly. Now, I don't think global warming is going to go away at the strike of some absurd, irrational Republican administration, should it happen again, ever again. I doubt if it ever will. I think we need to hold true to the notion that urbanism is an answer to all the problems, not an answer to a problem. And that's so at the same time that I'm going to delve into numbers, and I do think we can ride the pony of saying this is going to be a big part of the real solution, not the technical fix, but the real solution to most of our environmental problems. We have to prove it out with numbers. And the numbers only work at the regional scale. It's very hard for us to claim at the scale of a neighborhood or at the scale of a project that people's travel behavior will change. It just doesn't. People's travel behavior changes when the whole region reconfigures itself and provides different levels of compactness and different infrastructure. And that's why these regional scale plans are really at the heart of, I think, of realizing the true benefits of urbanism. And, you know, as we look at legislation both at the state of California level and at the federal level right now, I think we have to ask in both cases for the MPOs, the Metropolitan Planning Organizations, to begin to do regional plans that that have targeted reductions in VMT. This is a fundamental policy shift that will advance urbanism in all situations across this country. In California, we just passed a law called SB 375 and coupled with AB 32, which is our target of reducing carbon emissions, of which the regional land use component is one component, it's not all of it. We have a good model of that going forward. So for the first time, the MPOs in California are going to be under the gun, not unlike what everybody said was a unique circumstance in Portland, where we had regional government with some real authority. The regional entities in California just got real authority. Why? Because they are mandated to deliver carbon reductions in the form of VMT reductions, and they will be monitored. And if they don't succeed, they don't get their highway dollars. And, of course, that's the biggest stick in any room in government. And, of course, how we spend transportation dollars is, is of course, the great form giver for our regions and, in many cases, for our neighborhoods. We all know that here. So that's the larger framework, and let me drill into it a little bit. You know, this question of urbanism and energy, you can take a very broad sweep, and this is a graph I've been showing for 35 years, where it just shows that a typical urban dwelling, of course, takes a lot less energy, therefore a lot less carbon emissions, than a typical suburban, and even than green suburbia. So the whole idea of retrofitting suburbia and putting everybody in Priuses is an improvement. There's no question about it. But it doesn't even get us to where we can be with just straight good urban development. And then, of course, green urbanism is the point, I believe, of what we're about here at CNU. Now, this is the national average. Be careful. It's very different in different places. This is the average in California. Now, household energy use is way down. Why? Because 35 years ago, Jerry Brown passed the Title 24, which was the most advanced energy conservation standards for buildings in the nation then. And it has resulted not only in a complete mitigation of our energy consumption in buildings in compared to the rest of the country, it actually makes California the leader in per capita energy consumption, or, you know, lowest per capita energy in the nation by a long shot. So, there are other regulatory frameworks. LEED is nice. It's voluntary. We need new national standards that say our buildings are going to perform well. And that should be one of the other A priorities. Now, we know. So, and of course, we have a more benign climate than many places in the country. So you see here, the message of this slide is it's all about transportation. And transportation is all about urban design. And so we play the central role in California. And this just reinforces energy, greenhouse gas emissions on the demand side. It's all transportation, residential, commercial buildings. Of course, as you move to urbanism, that profile reduces naturally because of the more compact, efficient buildings. And the other things are things that will be dealt with as point source. I think that this is the Center for Neighborhood Technology has been producing these graphs around the country that just make the point to those of you who haven't seen this one yet, and I think everybody in this room has, that if you look at it on a per capita basis, cities are the most energy efficient, of course, CO2 per household, where downtown Chicago becomes blue. That's the best place. But if you look at it at CO2 as a function of area, then this is the kind of misguided environmentalist view of the world, which is the lower density it is, the less environmental impact it has, which, of course, is completely specious, but that's what this is how they see the world. So there is a conflict now, and I will agree more and more we have problems with our environmental partners. It's interesting that we have environmental, we have city advocate groups wanting to join hands with us, even the ULI at this point, developers wanting to join hands, but only some rare, like NRDC, environmental groups are willing to really sign up to the smart growth agenda. That may be overstatement, but I'd rather provoke them. I'm in several, deep battles right now with Sierra Club, so I'm particularly pissed off about the whole thing. This is another very, very important map. This is VMT per household by census tract. John Holtzclaw has been doing these for years and years. And you see in the Bay Area, where you build matters. You could even build a crummy project in, say, Redwood City or Oakland or Berkeley, and your average VMT is going to be half of what it is out in the towards the Central Valley. Alameda here. This is Livermore. The Livermore lab is out in this area here, and that, of course, is close to 30,000 VMT per household. So there's a 2-to-1 across this. And, of course, if you mapped job location, it turns out that those green zones overlay perfectly with the job centers. And so we actually have some very simple, very clear ways of determining where development should happen. Now, we all know form follows demographics, and we all know the numbers are changing, and we know this history of the shift away from Ozzie and Harriet to a much more diverse set of demands. And part of the reason I believe that we've had this huge economic meltdown in the residential area is not just that we created phony credit opportunities, but because we built the wrong stuff. We built as if everybody was a big family, when the reality is the market was for a completely different set of housing opportunities. Now, this is what's interesting. Going forward to 2025, household formation in the United States, only 4% of new households between now and 2025 will be households with children. I mean, excuse me, 4 million. And 28 million will be households without children. That's the next generation of demand. So there's about 32 million new households that will be formed in that period of time, unless something pretty interesting happens. And the vast majority of it is singles, empty nesters, childless couples. For whatever reason we are in this demographic cycle, even more extreme way than we've been working with for the last 20 years, we need to reshape housing policy to satisfy the needs of the families that we really are taking care of. And this has led A.C. Nelson, who we should get to talk at our conferences. Have we ever had him here? Was he here? He's been around. He's a great guy, and he's been, arguing our case and putting hard numbers to it. And he wrote this very, very important document for the APA, for JABA, recently, that looks at what future demand in terms of housing. And what he discovered is, if you go out to 2025, we've already built enough. There's three sets of bars on the right here. Is the supply is red, the green is demand, and the yellow is what's needed. So what he's pointing out is that we have so overbuilt large lot single family in America, we don't need to build another unit between now and for the next 20 years. So this is pretty radical shift. Now, the financing industry and the home builders may come back and do it anyway. We all know that. That's the problem. But at least we have the data in our hands and we can say, no, this is absolutely the wrong thing. Now, this is Scott Bernstein from Center for Neighborhood Technology, where he's showing very simply the economics of urban housing versus suburban housing. And and he does a very simple and I think very powerful calculation. Three-car household, 35,000 VMT. Two-car, 25. One-car, 15. And a house without a car but buys into the car share. And you can see here that red being the housing cost, you can spend more and more money on your house and still have a much smaller percentage of your household income going to transportation and housing. So you can easily trade transportation dollars for housing quality and location. And so this whole thing of drive till you qualify, which is, I guess, what the a lot of people say drives the single-family exurban sprawl, really isn't necessary if people take this whole systems approach to that. Now, the other thing people say about regional plans is that they're, well, first of all, we can't do them unless you're Oregon because we don't have state laws. That's bullshit. Secondly, they don't really work, or it takes a really long time for them to work, and the results are ambiguous. But you all know my advocacy in Portland, but here's the amazing data, finally. You live long enough, and you get to draw these graphs that span decades. So I went to work for 1,000 Friends of Oregon in 1989, and we did that radical plan that said, no Beltway freeway, let's build the West Side Light Rail Line. In 93, Metro, the regional government in Portland, adopted basically that plan, kept the urban growth boundary, and started enforcing it. And you can see in 96, the impact begins to be felt. And ever since 96, VMT per, is this per household or per capita? Per person, has been falling at where the national average has been rising. Regional planning really matters. And it's this kind of data that I think can convince policymakers to actually change laws. Now, in California, the big fight is basically what's going on is we now have this AB 32. We have the targets for overall greenhouse gas emissions, but none of the politicians want to touch what they consider the third rail, land use. Land use is a mess. It's an ugly process. And they want to leave it to local governments to listen to NIMBYs shouting, all, you know, night after night about how much they don't want anything to happen in their community. And the last thing the MPO wants or the state government wants is to get involved with what they consider to be, and let them have it, land use planning. And so their attitude is they're going to fix this with vehicle efficiency and a greenhouse fuel content. But when you think about greenhouse gas in transportation, the third leg, of course, is VMT, and that's the most significant. And here's a very illegible graph that tells you why that happens. Maybe I'll skip it. No. What this graph says is, look, if VMT rises as it is, by 2030, it'll be 60% higher per capita. If you increase miles per gallon, the green line, by 30%, which is what the target is right now, that's good. If you take the purple line, fuel greenhouse gas emissions, and you reduce carbon content in the fuel by 10%, that's good. But the end result, the blue line, still is up 12% over 05. And the target is to get down to 1990. So you can't get there with Priuses and biofuels. You have to go to basic issues of land use and travel behavior. And so we can put that one aside. Now, in California, we have this interesting political nexus, not only between this new law about regional planning, and believe it or not, the law states that every region, this was really warmed my heart, had to create a sustainable community plan. And that's the term of art that they now use. And every region is going to produce the Sustainable Community Plan, SCPs. They don't actually want to say the word sustainable, so they just use the acronym. Simultaneously, we voted in, miraculously, high-speed rail in the November ballot. We have about a third of the money in our bond, $10 billion. It's a $30 billion project to run from San Diego through L.A., to Sacramento and San Francisco. They were immediately attacked. Believe it or not, the environmentalists have all ganged up against high-speed rail. Why? And actually, this is a reasonable concern, and it's one that once again points to the fact that we can't get where we need to go without solid, powerful regional planning. They're worried, and I think quite rightly so, that will turn the Central Valley into a bedroom community for the wealthy coastal cities. All the jobs are already on the coast, and the cheap housing is inland, and it will be a catalyst for sprawl in the Central Valley. It is a concern. And without decent regional planning, you can't make high-speed rail an armature of smart growth. It can become an armature of sprawl. And so, you know, as much as... But it is a technology we need and must put in place. And so with it, we need to couple it to very powerful regulatory standards at the regional level. So the High-Speed Rail Authority and a few other groups, NRDC and League of Conservation Voters and Local Government Commission, a group got together and hired us to do a smart growth picture of the whole state of California. You know, I love to do regional plans, but now I want to do state plans. to try and deal with this issue of how can high-speed rail not generate sprawl and, you know, turn California into a two-tier environment, coastal wealth and services inboard, and that's actually the way it is right now. This is the mapping of the high-speed rail system. It runs through the MPOs that represent 93% of the whole state's population. Now, there's going to be, now you're going to get, you want to go to sleep, it's morning, but we're going to get into some heavy numbers here, and I'll just try and summarize what's the point of this. There are growth patterns here, but the real end result is that right now we don't have jobs housing balances in our regions in California. I haven't studied it. Now, when we did work in Portland and other places, there was always a jobs housing balance because each region was very, very isolated. Now, you've been hearing about mega regions, I think that it's a very important concept. But whenever regions start growing together, you start getting cross commutes region to region. And that becomes a very unhealthy phenomenon. In California, that's the phenomena of poor people living in the Central Valley and commuting 3 hours to the jobs in the Bay Area. So this is an issue that's going to keep coming up. So jobs housing balance within each region is very important. Now, optimizing it, you want jobs housing balances, and Robert Severo is the one who's done all the groundbreaking work on this, at about 5 mile commute sheds from major employment centers. So that's actually sub-regional jobs housing balance is what you really need. But the first target has to be regional jobs housing balance. We don't have it in the Bay Area. We haven't had it, and it's because of all the NIMBYs and the weakness of the regional entity. And so we've been exporting. People are commuting in from outside the 9-county Bay Area. These are the ratios. Right now there's 120,000 people who commute into the region from outside. And the environmental burden of this is giant. This is how I calculate the new job projection for the Bay Area, 1.7. We know, this is one of the, you know, the most innovative job machines in the planet, and it's going to remain so. So the jobs aren't going away. The catalytic quality, the mix of businesses that are happening in Silicon Valley and San Francisco and Oakland and Berkeley and all the rest of that, it's just not going to go away. The housing demand for 1.7 million jobs is 1.2 million households, and our region is only planning for 720. That's what they actually have on the books. They don't even deliver that. That's what ABAG, our regional government, says you should get. They assign housing numbers to each city, and most of the cities ignore it because they can, because there are no consequences. And so I figure we're about 500,000 houses short, which really changes the picture for the intensity of urbanism that we need to evolve into at a regional scale. But you see how all these things cascade. Now, the new law, SB 375, requires not only that the MPO does a sustainable community plan that reduces VMT, it also requires jobs housing balance. So it's a very radical step. This is the, you know, I'll give you now how we're going to approach this, because we could not approach a statewide plan using the old tool of travel analysis zones and the four-step gravity model, which is what we used to do. And it was always unsatisfactory. For those of you who don't understand the nuts and bolts there, each region runs this big computer model that is biased towards freeways and cars, and is completely, you know, used to be completely oblivious to the impacts of urbanism and mode shift away from cars and trip distances and all the rest of that. So we would put in all this great urbanism, and the VMT numbers wouldn't change very much because the model was too dumb to do it. So we have a problem with the model. People have been twiddling with the knobs and trying to fix that for 15 years. It's better than it used to be. It's still not good enough. So we've evolved a whole new approach, and it's a scenario modeling. We're going to develop various scenarios that will look at environmental, fiscal, and social issues. Now, Andreas is going to be happy with me. I'm finally using the transect. So we really are all together. I'm just the slowest kid in the class, that's all. We're developing a series of place types that are more detailed than transect zones because they go to the issues that actually control travel behavior and energy consumption. And a transect zone by itself isn't detailed enough in its locational descriptors and its mix, the quality of the mix, because it's ambiguous about mix. So basically what we have is this first column is mixed-use types. That's what we know as urbanism, urban, city, town, village. We have the suburban types, which will still happen, commercial and residential single-family zones. We have employment areas that are either in the urban transect zones or sit outside, and then we have institutional. And this is really quite an extensive list. Now, that's not enough. We can describe an exhaustive set of place types, but these are now the more highly evolved elasticity variables, these guys like to call it, fancy names like that. Obviously, what will impact travel behavior? Density, we know that. Diversity, the amount of mixed use, the amount of local destinations. Design, the walkability of the streets, the scale of the and quality of the walking environment. The proximity to destinations, to major destinations, those employment centers. So where in the region, you could take the same urbanism and put it in two different places in the region and it will have different travel behavior. And so we have to get precise enough to be able to nail that. So proximity to destinations, distance to transit is, of course, another key. You could have a great piece of urbanism without a light rail line or a streetcar, and so that is another key variable that results in how the place will perform. The scale of it, piecemeal development never really operates as well as cohesive larger neighborhood plans. The demographics, you can have exactly the same built environment, but if for some reason there's a skew in the demographics, i.e., if it's all low income, which we know happens with urbanism, that will have a totally different environmental travel behavior impact than if it's mixed income or if it's really high income. If it's really high income, the VMT is going to be high, unfortunately, because rich people got to drive those fancy cars. And then a final variable, the eighth variable, is demand management. What kind of policies are in place, parking prices, road pricing, things like that? All these things impinge on the urbanism. So the urbanism is not a sufficient criteria for us to arrive at the numbers we need to drive home the value of urbanism. And this is the way we're planning on getting at it. So what we do is we take these place types. Each of the place types has these assumptions. The model analysis gives us the following end results: VMT, travel mode, greenhouse gas emissions, air pollution, energy use. You can read. The neat thing is we can get a lot of variables. We've even now added health impacts as an output by place type, but the place type with its eight variables. So here's a first pass at California. You're talking about an additional 10 million, almost a doubling of the state by 2050. And we just did, for the heck of it, because we actually don't have this model completed yet, but we have it completed partly, so we thought, let's just take a quick trend. So let's do trend where only 30% of the new growth is new urbanist smart growth. And let's do a smart growth low. I don't know where we got these names, but and that's 50-50. And then, of course, smart growth high being almost all good, solid urbanism and very little sprawl. And this then, this is, we can get all sorts of outputs for this, but what's fascinating is that that means that when you cross that with building types, you end up with this spectrum of building types. And in the smart high, the smart growth scenario, if you put small lot detached, single family, townhouse, which is the green, and multifamily together, you have 86% of all new housing. That's about right. That's where we need to be just from the marketplace, putting aside the environmental side. And so the end results of this right now as a statewide calculation, and these are all the numbers, and I'm not even going to bother to go through them, but the bottom line is we win always, right? And so urbanism wins on every level. We need to be able to present that in a convincing way, and we need to back it up with numbers because there are all those cynics out there being paid for by right-wing think tanks who spend more time trying to falsify information than we do. Which is sometimes hard for them to do. And I'll let you take that in your own meaning. So we're going to save more land in California by doing smart growth than all of Delaware and Rhode Island. Now, I don't think that's such a big number, really. I mean, Delaware and Rhode Island is nothing. Who cares? But the reality is that those are so small, those states. But the reality is it's probably, if you go to trend, it's all in the Central Valley. It's all on prime ag land. It is not going to be, some of it will be in the Sierra foothills, but there are no jobs out there. That's too far to commute. It's not near the high-speed rail. It's all going to end up in the worst possible environmental location, and we'll get into that more later. The infrastructure savings, I'm amazed to see how consistent these numbers. When we did the Envision Utah plan and we did the smart growth versus not, we ended up with $30,000 per household of infrastructure soft savings with smart growth, and lo and behold, we're kind of at the same place here. Cumulative VMT reduction, here's the big one. It's as if we took all the cars, as if everybody stopped driving for 9 years out of the 40 years between now and 2050. These are really huge differences, and we want the politicians to wake up to the fact to how big these differences are and stop fiddling around with 100% technical fixes and start using urbanism as the foundational fix. Fuel consumed, this is just for the state of California, and we're looking at a year of imports to all USA. The fuel costs per household, $50,000 cumulative. The total building energy reduction, these graphs go on and on and on, and that's the point. And so this is the big one, of course, the carbon emissions. It's basically to sequester that amount of carbon would take New Jersey. That's a little bigger, isn't it, than Rhode Island? I don't know these East Coast states. So that's what we're doing at that state level. I wanted to show a couple how we can use these kind of numbers because, I don't know about you guys, but we have to fight still to get smart growth approved. And so I want to show some of our projects and how these numbers play into that. Alameda Point is an old naval area right across the bay from San Francisco, perfectly located, and we're looking at, tragically, only 4,000 units. It should be, in my mind, 15,000, but it's California, and nobody has a stomach for more. It's a nice plan, great, if I do say so myself, but the key here, of course, is the transit connections to BART and the fact that it's centrally located in one of the major job centers. I would still say a site like this could operate without any transit and still be better than Tracy and Livermore and the more distant suburbs just because the job centers are closer. But, of course, this is all gilding the lily. There's active carbon neutrality through using a solar farm that is also a cogeneration facility. And this is something I talk about all the time, but I'm not going to get into now. But here's what we're able to actually show the public officials. If you don't build a house in Alameda, it will end up in the Central Valley because we are not creating enough space. And the cost of that Central Valley house in terms of kilowatt hours per household, because it needs air conditioners, you're moving from one climate zone to another, is much higher. Bay Area infill and Alameda Point. Vehicle miles traveled, the same profile, and greenhouse gas. There's a 1-to-5 ratio. Every house we export out of the Bay Area will have 5 times the greenhouse gas impact. And these are numbers that make people stop and think. And it kind of marginalizes the NIMBYs, who too often have been claiming that they are the advocates of preserving the environment. Water use is also a huge issue in California. So dense urbanism, and of course, is the big answer there. I presented this plan last night at a private party. I thought I'd show it again, but it's the same kind of thing. Here's a huge opportunity to embed development right at the heart of Silicon Valley. Redwood City is one of the major job centers and, of course, midpoint in the Central Valley. And these are the same kind of numbers I gave you about our housing shortfall. The peninsula alone has 200,000 units short. It's why the home prices in the Bay Area are astronomical. Now, where jobs are healthy, this is going to happen over and over again, and we need to satisfy that need with transit. Now, here's the high-speed rail. The whole transit network places Saltworks at the center of it, and the same framework of savings are put in. And then what we did here, which was exciting to me, was basically take half the site and give it up for open space, public parks, and wetlands restoration. So this is a true integration of the environmental component being 50-50 with the urban development program. The transit system will link from a new ferry terminal. There are jobs and development all around this site. And the developer here, in the tradition of the old streetcar developers who used to build streetcars in exchange for creating land value, this developer, DMB, is going to build this system all the way across the freeway with a new bridge into this area, which is a big employment center of Stanford, will help pay for the connection from the new ferry terminal out here. Otherwise, that ferry terminal would have been landlocked. So how these things go as regional solutions, as environmental solutions, as livability solutions. Finally, I just wanted to show one other project, which is very exciting to me, in Toronto, because it just shows how far short we are falling, quite frankly. Toronto has an amazing regional plan. It's very clear and very simple. There's their green belt, and they have designated areas that they're calling urban centers, and they set minimum densities for those urban centers. So they're not allowed to build low density at the urban centers. And the urban centers are at strategic transit crossroads. And this one is out in the suburbs. Here's downtown Toronto here. But this particular site, Langstaff, is at the junction of 3 transit lines, a subway from downtown on Yonge Street, a commute train, and an east-west light rail system that's coming across the 407. So all 3 of those systems land there. And the most amazing thing happens, as we were working this out, we started pushing the numbers higher and higher in terms of, finally, even the city there said, well, maybe this is too dense. Our traffic engineer stood up and said something quite amazing. He said, you know, for decades we've been designing our communities according to the road capacity. Why don't we design according to the transit capacity? These 3 transit systems have 56,000 passenger peak hour potential. And he said that should be the thing that limits the development on this site, not the roads around the site, but the transit capacity. And it was a kind of a fundamental shift in the way of thinking about what is the right criteria to apply. So we've created this plan. There's the commute trains here, the east-west light rail here is in between the 2 freeways, and the subway is down here at this end. Long and short is that it's a high-rise city. This is 100 gross acres with 15,000 units, and we would never even consider that in the United States, and yet it is the kind of lifestyle And it's the kind of thing that we should be headed towards. Now, I know high-rise is controversial among this very sensitive group of new urbanists, but I think Jane Jacobs came from a high-rise city, and she loved it, and she never had a problem with it. And we, being in Toronto, we played off of her standards. And so this was the framework, small blocks and interconnected street grids, streets for people, and this spine of green space that led to main streets and transit nodes that were lined either by civic uses in blue or commercial and retail in red, a whole series of open space. But this is the scale of this enterprise. And the fascinating thing is not only has it been approved, and there wasn't a lot of opposition to this kind of density, but the developers see a huge market for this kind of intense living. The components, this is not quite the Vancouver model of slender, it is slender towers, but the base of the blocks is not townhouses, it's largely eight-story, so it's much more intense actually than even downtown Vancouver. And so that's the framework we were able to mass up. And the block types of building types look like this is the variety of things that we're looking at as part of that. So one of the ways that we justified the thing in the end was we said, look, I can take you to places in your own region where the travel behavior is what we expect to happen here. So in York, these are all places you don't know, 5% mode split to bus. In South Oakville, they all know it. This is a technique you should use in these projects, in your projects. South Oakville, 8% mode split to rail. Langstaff itself, which is where this is, 18% carpool. North York has a 25 mode split. These are all suburban locations. These are not downtown Toronto. And then St. Lawrence is 15% walk bike. That adds up to a 71% non-auto mode split. So it's a pretty handy way of justifying the kind of density that we have. And so that's the end of my talk. I always end with this. Let's not forget what our fundamental principles are. And in all cases, I think we always need to look at diversity and balance, mixed use. Leon Creer is here today, and I know he doesn't like my high-rises, but he probably doesn't like the fact that I stole his drawing and have been using it for 20 years, but that's what that drawing is. The civic domain, the commercial and the residential mixed together. The human scale, and then the two new elements of new urbanism, conservation and restoration, as per the salt flats, where 50% of the site is restoration of natural habitat and the interface between that and urbanism. And then, of course, understanding urbanism in its larger context. Those two are not attributes of historic urbanism, and I think they are what we bring to the table, and it's what makes new urbanism so extraordinarily important today. Thank you. Thank you.